Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Cindy DeFerdinand, only on LA Talk Radio.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to LA Talk Radio's Concierge Coaches Show. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Cindy DeFerdinand, bringing you another action-packed episode. How's it going, Cindy?
Good. Hi, everybody. Hope everybody's having a good day. Fabulous guest on today, Bruce is going to introduce.
Yes, we do. You know, a few weeks back, I guess a month or so now, I was in the Miami area doing some coaching and work and whatnot, and had the pleasure, the distinct pleasure of meeting our guest today. Folks, this man is an attorney in the South Florida area, and a lot of his practice is dedicated toward recovery efforts. And something that's just so interesting is Florida has something called the Marchman Act. And the Marchman Act is a mechanism by which folks that are really struggling with their substance use issues can be placed into treatment, let's say, a little bit quicker with the assistance of a judge and whatnot. So I don't want to go much more than that without hearing it from virtually the source itself. So Mark Astor, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Mark, how are you doing?
Bruce, how are you? Thank you very much for having me on your show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, man, it's a pleasure to talk to you, brother. And, boy, I was on your website. You'll be able to talk about that later toward the end. But, yeah, Mario's a great website. He has a bunch of FAQ videos, and he very succinctly answers the question in his videos. God love you for doing that. I hate these people that drone on and on and say nothing. So your site's just awesome. It's on point.
Good content.
Good logo, good coloring. It's just awesome. So props to you, Mark, for that really championship website. Really, I think it does your business a service, and it's always good to see somebody who is on top of their game with their website as well as their service line. So if you could, describe for our listeners a little bit about what the Marchman Act is, what it isn't, and we'll just kind of pick it up from there.
Okay, great. So the Marchman Act is a civil proceeding, and it is specifically designed for people who are dealing with substance abuse issues and sometimes a co-occurring mental health issue. And what it does is that it allows a family member, it could be a spouse, it could be a parent, it could be a legal guardian, it could even be just one friend. It allows those individuals to petition the courts, ask a judge to send their loved one for an assessment, stabilization, and detoxification, which is one part of the process. And then based on what the assessment says, then the judge can then order that individual into residential treatment for up to 90 days. And if during that period they walk out, I can then go back to the court and say, Judge, they are ignoring your court order to stay into treatment. Please send the sheriff to go and get them and bring them back before the court. So it's a way of forcing somebody into treatment is what it is.
Now, I just want to ask, you know, you were saying it could be a loved one, it could be a parent, it could be a spouse, a friend. Can it be an employer?
That's a good question. I haven't actually been asked that question before, but I would think that if that person qualifies, quote unquote, as a friend, and they can establish the statutory criteria that the person is is under the influence of some kind of substance abuse, they're not capable of making a rational decision to submit themselves to treatment as a result, and they're potentially a threat to themselves or somebody else, then I think that that might well actually work. Yeah, it's a great question.
Yeah, because it may be a way to address and handle it in the workplace, because there's a lot of employers that have a lot of compassion and concern for good employees or even excellent employees that are falling by the wayside because of a substance abuse problem.
Well, actually, I think it's a bigger issue than that. It's because it's classified as a disease. I think actually if you go and terminate somebody because they're they are dealing with disease. I think, you know, you said that employer is then subjected, potentially could be subjected to a lawsuit for discrimination. So,
right.
I mean, I think it's in the employer's best interest to want to try and help the employee. And if,
I agree.
And if they've invested money in the employee, then I would think they'd want to help.
Exactly.
Hey, and Mark, you know my dealings with the feds back in the day in my first life. And he's laughing, man. Boy, I tell you what. And, you know, ironically, right, back in the late 80s when this war on drugs got kicked off, that the Supreme Court ruled that alcoholism was not a disease, but it was a disease in state that was caused by a period of willful misconduct. And therefore, drug use and whatnot. Yeah, drug use and cocaine use had been criminalized in this country. Of course, I reap the benefits of that, being a war on drugs child and being brought in to the Justice Department in the early 90s and at Butner, North Carolina, and all this other stuff, and literally riding that wave right into the war on sex offenders, which is another show. But anyway, so Mark, I mean, this is a really interesting thing. When judges are weighing the evidence, I mean, does this look like – do we have to have some sort of valence here? In other words, there's a magnitude. It's almost like, I don't want to say it's like an NGRI, but the person really is experiencing enough psychopathology as a result of their substance addiction that they're unable. Is it just a straight harm question? Are they a harm to themselves or others? Mm-hmm. Or is there some other mental competency issues along with that decision?
So I think the word harm can be somewhat generic. I mean, for instance, had a case that we looked at where the harm was financial. We were contacted by a family and they said, "Hey, we want to look at Marchman acting our sister because she's living with our mom and she's depleting the financial assets of the mother. The mother was elderly and really wasn't able to keep track of finances." So the harm could potentially be financial, and when that comes into play, then you may be looking at a guardianship as well, so that you can take control of the mother's assets. That's something that I tend to do as well, if that becomes an issue. But so harm can be, isn't just, they're out to physically harm, to harm themselves. Although, sometimes, a lot of the time when you're dealing with mental health too, that person is at risk, can be at risk of, potentially taking their own life.
Exactly. So, very, very high risk with any kind of mental illness. And then on top of it, substance abuse.
Now, right. In Florida, go ahead. I was going to ask you about the Baker. Well, is the Baker Act in Florida? Is that the mental health side of this?
So the Baker Act is the mental health side of things. And that's the sort of the act that everybody seems to have heard about and know about when it comes to mental health. The problem with the Baker Act is it has very little teeth. It only allows for basically a 72-hour hold,
right,
in which the person can be stabilized, and it's typically done by law enforcement. Either a licensed professional is going to call the police and say, "Hey, I've got a patient in here, and I think that they potentially might hurt themselves. Would you please come and transport them to the nearest facility where they can be stabilized?" Or the police get called to the scene of a potential incident, and there's somebody there who says, who says, "I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to hurt myself," and then the police can initiate the Baker Act. So typically that's how that goes down. While the Marchman Act can be initiated by law enforcement, and it can also be initiated by a licensed professional, the hold can only be for 72 hours, and during that period of time, you're going to have to go and then file a petition with the courts if you want to have that recourse and be able to go back to a judge and say, "Hey, they walked out of treatment, please make them go back." So, you got to get the courts involved. That really is the beautiful thing about the Marchman Act, is you got a judge there who can help you.
So if somebody is committed for 72 hours via the Baker Act, then is that the time period that a family member, friend, whoever would have time to enforce the Marchman Act by going to the court?
So the petition can be filed by somebody without the help of a lawyer. But, as I tell people, that's sort of akin to trying to self-diagnose a medical issue. I mean, you make it much harder to do that, and you're probably going to get it wrong.
Right.
So if, say, somebody gets Baker Acted and the family comes to me and they say, "Hey, look, our son got Baker Acted, and we also know there's a substance abuse issue," I can file an emergency petition with the court and ask the court to, order them at least to be stabilized and detox and assess for substance abuse. So, and then what's going to happen is they can be held for up to 5 days. Then the court is, I'm going to file a second petition, which is the what they call the Marshman Act petition, which is asking the court to then order them into treatment post-assessment. So it can be done, but, you know, they got to get, you know, the good thing about what's going on in Florida now is that we now have an e-filing system. So family comes to me, they come to me at 2 o'clock. They give me all the facts. I draft the petition. And by 4 o'clock, I've electronically filed it. And worst case scenario is next morning, I call the clerk and say, has it been reviewed yet? So you can move pretty quick on these things if you know what you're doing.
Right, so, right. But of course, you have to know what you're doing. So hence, they need some professional support, right?
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't change your own oil unless you knew what you were doing, right? So in your car, you take it to get service. So it's the
right,
same type
exactly.
of thing, right?
I mean, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I wouldn't even know how to change oil.
Me neither.
Sadly, I do, but that was back early in my career. I had to change my own oil. But anyway, so Mark, what is the – is there a typical modal Marchman situation that you encounter? And if so, what does that look like?
So, you know, typically when a family comes to me, especially when you're dealing with a child, they're in crisis, right? They're in emotional crisis. And the only thing I can sort of say that's like is, I mean, I went through something like that recently. For the last couple of years, my father was very, very sick, and he passed away 4 months ago. But for the 2 years before he died, my mother and I, thank you, were constantly either calling 911 or rushing him to the emergency room. And so while my father was lying there in ICU and had tubes coming out of everywhere, you know, as a family, we were emotionally in crisis, right? I mean, and see that when a family comes to you, especially when they're dealing with a child, and when I say a child, it might be a teenager or a young adult, they're emotionally, they are in crisis, and you have to help them through that. So typically what's happened is that the family, from an emotional perspective, has really reached the bottom of the barrel. They just don't know what else to do. And their child is refusing to go into treatment, and they've heard about this thing called the Marchman Act, and they've gotten my name, and they come to me and they say, what can we do? And I say, listen, this is the process, and this is how it works. And it's very difficult for them because they feel, to a certain extent, they feel a little bit guilty, right? They're making their kid do something he or she doesn't want to do.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. The resistance would be there, even from the person enforcing it or trying to do it, because it sounds like they probably have exhausted all means of supporting and helping their child, or, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So there would be some resistance and that feeling of guilt of making somebody do it, yeah.
Right. And no parent wants to make their child feel uncomfortable or wants to feel like their child, you know, hates them or is mad at them. But, you know, the way I counsel my parents is I say, look, you know, one of two things are going to happen here. Either your child is going to continue to get worse and you're going to continue to do this battle, or something even, you know, ultimately they're going to end up taking their own life, either because they overdose or the mental health side of things takes control and they do the unthinkable and take their own life. It doesn't get better with time. It only gets worse. And that's the sort of, you know, the sort of tough love conversation as an objective counselor you have to have with the family. And, you know, sometimes it takes 2 or 3 meetings with the family for them to get to grips with the idea that if they don't take action, you know, they're going to be sorry.
Now, so typically, Mark, this is going to be a family coming to you and they're getting no sort of response from the child or the young adult in terms of getting help. No psychiatrist, no therapy, no meetings, no willingness to go into treatment. I mean, they're just exhausted all means and they've come up against non-compliance completely. Is that typically the case?
Sometimes what's happening is that the child is saying, I'm not doing it, there's nothing wrong with me. Or they've been to see a therapist and the therapist is telling the parents, look, you really need to put your child into an inpatient program. And the child's not going to do it, and the parents are refusing. Or the kid's been one of these people who's been in and out of treatment centers. They go for 10 days, they jump out. They go for 10 days, they jump out. And now they've been through multiple treatment centers. And because there's no recourse, and because, you know, treatment isn't a custodial setting like, you know, prison or jail, there's nothing the parents can do. So they go through this period where, you know, maybe after 10 days, the kid's detoxed, and they feel a little better, and the parents are like, oh, he's getting better. And then, you know, a month or two goes by and the kid relapses and they go through this cycle where it's sort of up and down, up and down, up and down. And you know, they don't know what to do. So
and very traumatizing, to
very,
say the least.
Very.
Yeah.
Very. I mean, I've sat there with families, and you know, the look of despair in the families, you know, and the parents is, it's heartbreaking. It really is. They're just sort of at their wits end. They just don't know what to do, and they're like, "Somebody help me! Just help me to fix my kid."
Right. Yeah, it's hard stuff.
If, and this is kind of a random question, but what if somebody absconds the state of Florida? Let's say they break out of treatment and they leave the state of Florida. Will there be a want or warrant against them, or this is more of a civil, right? There's not going to be any.
So that's a good question. I haven't actually dealt with that, but I think what would happen is, and you probably have experienced this yourself, because I was a prosecutor in the state system for a long time, and while you were dealing with the big guys.
I was
in the
fugitive myself for years, yes.
So typically what happens is if the person walks out of treatment, I'm going to run back to court, and I'm going to say, "Judge, they walked out, they ran, you know, they're gone," and the judge is going to issue a pickup order. Now, you know, let's say they're out of state. I think the big question is going to be is if they run to Georgia from Florida, and they go and run, you know, they run them through the NCIC system, you know, the national background check, and they see this pickup order from Florida. The issue is anybody going to want to pay to ship that person back from Georgia to Florida? Mm. And frankly, I don't know the answer to that question. It's a very good question, and I don't know if I have a real answer for you. I mean, obviously, if there's a felony warrant, yeah, somebody will pay to bring the person back. But on a pickup order, I would think that, you know, mom and dad may have to foot the bill for that.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I was, you know, Hala, I was just kind of curious because, look, I think that is, I think therapeutically, okay, so, you know, I'm trained as a therapist. I'm a sober coach, executive coach, all that stuff, right? And so with some of these young adults, I've kind of used that threat, if you will, or that reality, you know what I mean? To say, hey, man, look, just finish this thing out. That way it's really nice and clean. You don't have any kind of wants or warrants, you know what I mean? I always say the word wants, kind of old school language, but, you know, like the pickup order. And so so I think, you know, that's a very handy, useful thing. At least it does get loaded into the NCIC, and that's the National Crime Indexing system that all federal and state agencies use when you get pulled over for a speeding ticket or a cracked taillight. I mean, they put your stuff in there and make sure that routinely to make sure there's nothing wanted for you. So I think this leads to another piece I want to tell our listeners, and that is this, is there really is no difference in effective treatment, whether it was coerced or it was voluntary. So in other words, if you take people who have been committed for substance abuse treatment and you had another group of people who, you know, ran with open arms into the treatment center.
Voluntarily.
Thank you. Voluntarily. We would find that there wouldn't be a statistical difference in the outcome of sobriety between the groups. So
now that's interesting to me, because I would expect you would see more resistance in somebody who felt forced in.
Right. You're right. And us as coaches and our coaching ethic, right?
Right.
We're not talking about psychotherapy here or what Mark does as an attorney or what I did as a fed. We're talking about as coaches, we're very positive psychology. And what do you think your options are? And what do you want to do? And this is
how do you want to move forward?
Which is fine. Right. Yeah. Anyway, thank you. Hey, move forward and all this other good stuff. Well, hey, man, you know, at the end of the day, right now that the person is literally in the midst of this, of these disease, you know, disease state and operating in a very impaired state at this point, we really need to kind of up the ante and do what is necessary, if at all possible, so that this person can get the help that they need. And
be able to build their life at some point or move their life forward. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
But I still would think, when you say that there's no difference in terms of outcomes, statistically speaking, I guess, that would surprise me, because I would think that they would resist longer. But, you know, resist meaning just shut down to what's going on in treatment.
You know, to me.
What do you think, Mark? Have you seen stats on that? Have you seen, you know, the success rate? Do they have any published stats yet?
Yeah, so, you know, from what I've read online, I think Bruce is right on the money. I mean, you know, just because they're forced doesn't mean to say they won't, you know, they won't do well in treatment. And my experience typically is they're mostly most resistant at the beginning. And the reason that is because they need to be detoxed. I mean, right now, you know, the only thing they're thinking about is, you know, when are they getting their next fix? And they're going to lie, cheat, and steal to do it. They're not thinking about what, you know, this treatment. And so, you know, that initial sort of 5 to 7 day period when they're starting to detox is when they start to become just a little bit more rational. And that's what I see when I do a Marchman Act. You know, they spent maybe a week in the hospital and they're clean and they start to think a little bit more logically and they become a little bit more amenable to the treatment.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that makes sense.
Look, and look, folks, if we're going to look at this through a medical lens, right? And we're going to look at this as a disease and through a medical lens. Let's just plug in another variable. Group A has, Group A has a viral infection X. Group B has viral infection X. Both groups get the penicillin or the treatment or whatever, the antibiotics that they need, and both groups recover at the same rate. See what I'm saying? One group wanted to go to the doctor. The other group didn't go to the doctor. It makes no difference, right? But they were both encountered the cure, and I shouldn't say cure, but the treatment in this case, right? And you would expect that they would both respond the same, right? Because we're measuring the efficacy of the intervention, you know what I mean?
Right.
Not so
and
much the methodology of how they got to the into the door. So yeah.
Right. I'm with you. Okay, that makes sense.
Yep. So... You know, so I've always been a big defender, given my law enforcement background, a big defender of coerced treatment, a big advocate of that, you know. And again, at the end of the day, you're really not you're actually helping the person, their family, and society. So, I just think that is great. Now, another thing that I've thought of, Mark, in my conniving mind of federal crime for years is this somehow could the Marchman Act be abused? Could it be misused to line the pockets of court evaluators and others? You know what I mean? As more of an industry building vehicle for Florida. What are your I'm thinking out loud. I'm sure I'm wrong, but go ahead. What are your thoughts?
I've done criminal defense work since I got out of the state attorney's office in 1999, and a lot of that is dealing with people who, you know, get pinched for DUI, and their big gripe is that you know, the cost of DUI school and the fines and the court costs are more than it costs to hire me to represent them. And what I tell the clients is, look, you know, welcome to the legal system. Somebody somewhere, you know, is going to make money off of you, and that's kind of the nature of the beast. Mm-hmm. Now, saying that, I mean, obviously we're having a little bit of a dilemma here in South Florida because there, we've got a lot of treatment centers making a lot of money, and the big gripe has been that not all of them are providing the kind of treatment that they should be doing. In other words, they're more concerned about how much can they tap the person's insurance versus, you know, how well can they treat the clients and the patients. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that you're never going to take that that financial aspect out of it. I'm a big believer, actually, that maybe the private sector isn't the problem. The private sector really, I think, is the solution down here, especially in South Florida, because we don't have enough beds and the county and the state aren't able to provide enough facilities for indigent folks. The good news is, you know, our governor finally declared a state of emergency down here. He has access to $27 million, and I'm just wondering how quickly they can waste the money. I have my own personal thoughts on how it could be dealt with, but I think that, you know, the private sector is a good way to solve some of the problems and not giving it to government and bureaucracies to waste it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think in answer to your question, people are going to make money, but as long as they're doing the right thing and taking care of people,
right,
I'm
the right
okay
service,
with that.
I mean, the right service, right?
Right.
You know, with, you know, if their heart's in it and, you know, they're helping people. And I agree with you, like in the private sector, there's going to provide more availability of services for the masses that need it.
Right.
And private sectors can mobilize and have business models and staff on hand to be able to meet that need. So that, and I hope, and you know, hope that is indeed the case, and that you know, they're able to mobilize and get more people into treatment, because it's just an epidemic out there, particularly with the opiates right now as well. You know, just you know, marijuana, Xanax, and opiates. So just it seems like there's just no end in sight. You know, we're really really in bad shape out there with the number of new cases, particularly with the millennials and some of the, you know, these emerging 19, early 20s people out there. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a need to be filled. Now, Mark, I mean, you've probably been in a position. I know you're not a coach or a therapist, but I bet you've been in a position where you've been kind of part of the intervention team, right, where you were interacting with the families or the client to get them into actively engaged in the treatment. Has that been the case?
Sure. So, you know, sometimes, you know, the clients don't always come to me through, you know, looking for a marshmallow lawyer. They come to me because their, you know, their kid, their young adult is in the criminal justice system, and they've been sort of going through this revolving door, and things have just been getting worse. I mean, you know, we have the state sentencing guidelines a bit like you have the federal guidelines. And I used to say the more points you have, you know, the more time you get, you know, and that's kind of how it works, right? So if you keep getting arrested and convicted, you end up doing more and more time.
Right.
And what happens is you get a revolving door of folks who are going in and out of the criminal justice system, and they've got this substance abuse and, you know, potentially co-occurring mental health issue, and no one's ever addressed it. So the lawyer who had the two previous cases did the best he could or she could, and for whatever reason, that issue never got addressed. Then they come to you, they're facing serious prison time, and they're, you know, they're sitting in the, you know, the county jail because no judge wants to give them a bond, and the only way they're getting out is if they're going into treatment. And you know, my experience with the judges is if you are willing to get the person to treatment and get serious about taking care of what's really causing this problem, then I think there's an opportunity to save the client. And our sentencing guidelines do allow for that. So sometimes when it comes to intervention and getting the person to treatment, it's because they're in the criminal justice system and not because the families come to you looking for help, you know, to involve the civil courts on a Marchman Act process.
Right. That makes perfect sense. So it's really a big service to not only the client, as you said, you know, could save people's lives for sure, the cost, and then the cost to the family emotionally, financially. They just
right.
get to enter their ropes, and they need some support legally in order to get the job done.
They do, but I also try to make a point of saying to the family, look, you know, maybe you as a family, you know, while I'm handling the legal issues, maybe you need to go and talk to a therapist of some kind because, there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of anger going on here. And, you know, this isn't a quick fix that, you know, when you're in the criminal system, you know, this Bruce, right. You can be in, even on a simple felony case, you can be in the system for 6-9 months up to a year. And so this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And so while I'm taking care of the legal issues, maybe, you know, the family needs to sit down and have a chat with somebody, a therapist, who can help them to deal with what's going on, because the family's starting to fall apart over this.
Right. How to navigate it. And where does like intervention fit into this? Because that's always been the typical model when you have somebody who's not compliant, is get an intervention going. This seems to be a legal way of doing that, a little bit firmer way.
So, you know, I'm connected to a couple of interventions, and sometimes the interventionist will go to the family, you know, they'll sit down with the family and they'll say, look, we're going to do this intervention and we're going to tell your loved one they need to go to treatment and we're going to confront them with the issues that we've been seeing for the last several years. But ultimately, if you don't involve the courts vis-a-vis a Marchman Act process, even if they voluntarily go, they're going to almost certainly try to walk out at some point. And so, I mean, you know, especially in Florida, you know, we rely to a certain extent on the interventionists, you know, counseling the family that, you know, while they're doing the intervention, they should also consider seriously consulting with a Marchman Act lawyer to involve the court so that you have some significant leverage over mm-hmm. the person that you're seeking to do the intervention for.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yes. Now, Mark, have there been people from out of state transport their loved one into a hotel or something in Florida and then utilize the procedure to kind of finish the job of getting them into treatment, and or B, they're in treatment and they use a Marchman Act to you know, underneath as a safety line, you know, a non-Floridian, an out-of-state person. How does that apply as well, or?
Yes, yes. So, so the Marshman Act statute basically provides that once the person is in the state of Florida, whichever county they happen to be in, you can file a Marshman Act petition. So they don't have to be a resident. So,
interesting.
So if so, so what's been going on here in South Florida, and I think a lot of, and I think it's very similar to Arizona, you know, to California, is that the treatment centers down here are spending a lot of money marketing to, you know, people in New York and New Jersey and, you know, Massachusetts and Connecticut and obviously the West Coast, Nevada, California, Arizona, and saying, you know, come to Florida, you know, be by the ocean, get well. And what's happening is that, you know, families are sending their loved ones 1,500, 3,000 miles to go get treatment. You know, the person is supposed to be here for 30, 60, 90 days, and 15 days later, the person walks out, and, well, you know, there's no recourse.
Wow.
So the good treatment centers are telling families when they send their loved ones, you know, here for treatment and suggesting to them they should consult with a lawyer who does Marshman Act work so that if in the event their loved one walks out of treatment, there's some recourse. And so what the good treatment center is doing is making that recommendation. So when the person touches down in say, you know, a Fort Lauderdale airport or West Palm Beach airport, they get picked up by the treatment center. As soon as they arrive at the treatment center, they're getting served with the Marshman Act petition. And, you know, oh, by the way, we have court tomorrow. And, you know, you're going to be staying with us for a little while. And if you walk out, this is what's going to happen to you. So I think it's a very, very underutilized tool when it comes to dealing with people who are coming here for treatment. I mean, if you want to bring people here for treatment, great. But I think it is outrageous, and I think it's unethical, and I think it's negligent to, for lack of a better word, invite people to send their loved ones here for treatment and then not give them any recourse.
Right. Especially when it's available.
I think it's terrible.
Yeah. And
I think it's terrible.
Do they know it's available? Do the treatment centers know that it's available? Obviously, they must be aware of it in the state of Florida.
Absolutely. And in mm-hmm. fact, my big dilemma has been that I spend a lot of time talking to members of the public. I go on shows like yours, and I write about it, and I blog about it. And what I found is that outside of the treatment industry, people, the general public doesn't know about the Marshman Act. I mean,
right.
Somebody in California has probably never heard of the Marshman Act. You know, somebody in Palm Beach County where I am hasn't heard of the Marshman Act. And so, you know, to a certain extent, we're relying on the treatment centers to tell these people, listen, you know, you should at least consult with a lawyer to see if, you know, you meet the criteria for a Marshman Act. Because otherwise, you know, tragedies happen. And I can tell you, I wrote about one recently that happened where I had a call on a case. And before we get the petition filed, you know, the young lady was dead. It's tragic, and
right.
She came here
yeah.
out of state. She came here from out of state for treatment, and it wasn't until after she walked out and people got nervous about her well being that they said, "Oh, you need to call a Marshman Act lawyer." And I was like, "You should have had that conversation before she walked out.
Be proactive about it." Are there other states looking to enforce it to bring
or
the
similar
same
act?
So the only other state that I'm aware of that does anything like this is Kentucky. I think they have a law. It's called Casey's Law. And I think it's named after, you know, a child who passed away from drug addiction. And I believe theirs is somewhat similar. I haven't looked at all the statutory criteria, but from what I've read, it's, you know, the basis, you know, it's the same sort of idea whether, you know, you're looking to involuntarily commit somebody who's dealing with substance abuse. But for the most part, I mean, this is it. I mean, most states have a mental health statute, but they don't have what we have here in the Marshman Act.
Right. And how long has it been in Florida, the Marshman Act?
It's been on the books since 1993.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So quite a while.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And, you know, we've got Marshman Act courts, you know, and we've got magistrates that are handling these specific types of cases, you know, who are designated to handle only Marshman Acts. So, which is great because they understand the soup to nuts of the statutory criteria. You understand, you know, the evidence. I mean, you know, I was just in Fort Lauderdale this morning in front of a magistrate in Broward, and, you know, it was a pleasure to be in front of the judge. I mean, he just, you know, he got it. He understood how things worked, and it was, you know, it wasn't a difficult process. So,
nice. Efficient. That's what you need, right?
Yeah, it's efficient. It's exactly right. It's efficient. But it does vary from county to county, you know, for some reason. I don't know why that is. There doesn't seem to be a lot of uniformity, but, I mean, it is what it is.
Now, are they gathering the momentum of some statistics, some success stories, so that they, you know, can show that it is working, and therefore treatment centers should get on board a little bit more, since they are the key educators?
As far as success under the Marchman Act?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any numbers for that, but I can tell you from what the clerk of the court tells me, I think in Palm Beach County alone they had, I think it was something like 3,500 petitions filed last year alone, just for Marchman Acts, which is a significant amount. I mean, but you got to remember, probably the majority of those are not filed. They're not filed with lawyers involved. So, I mean, what's happening is that you get a family, they're having to refile because they just constantly get the criteria right. You know, there's certain things that need to be established.
Right.
And if you don't get it right, the judge is not going to grant it because it just isn't.
Right. And then you have to do it over. Yeah. Do it again. What a waste of time. Right.
Right.
I think that, when I was in California and I was visiting some treatment centers out there, and then I was at some sort of a treatment-oriented conference, and everybody's like, yeah, well, it's not like Florida. You know what you can do in Florida. It kind of piqued my interest. This about a year and a half ago. And I'm like, well, what about Florida? Well, they got this whole Marchman Act thing. And I was like, what? I'd been in the business for a little bit, and they kind of like, wow, I didn't even know that was there, and that makes sense, and why there's, all these, treatment centers out there. And like you said, Florida's a big draw for treatment centers like California is. It's the weather. It's by the ocean. It's a good climate and all those things. And it's, very, very conducive for rehabilitation and treatment. So you're right. That boggles my mind that this has been on the book since
1993. Wow.
I know. That's amazing. Well, let me ask you this, Mark. I mean, I know you've done a lot of shows and stuff. Is there something that our listeners or we would need to know that you haven't been able to talk about when you're on somebody's show and you get hamstrung by the usual questions? Are there any other aspects about what you do or the Marchman Act that you'd like to share?
I think the biggest thing is getting the word out, I think that drug addiction is, it's almost a bit like cancer, right? I mean, everybody knows somebody that's had cancer, and everybody knows somebody that is dealing with this issue. And what I would say to those folks who are listening to us is, if you know somebody that is dealing with this issue, don't let it go on, right? Because it's like cancer, it'll just metastasize and it'll just get worse. So if you know somebody, have them call a lawyer like me. I mean, I do not charge to consult with people. I have access to tons of free resources. If they need an interventionist, or if they need a recommendation for a treatment center, I'm happy to give it. I do not charge for access to those resources. And I consider it a public service to make those things available. So if you know somebody, don't sit idly by, take action. Because if you don't, then the worst can happen. And so that's what I would say to people, is to be proactive. And if you know somebody, your family's dealing with it, say, listen, I was listening to the radio today, and there's a lawyer out there who has access, can give you access to free resources. And apparently there's this statute out there that can help you. You should give them a call and, have that free consultation. And that's what I would say. I mean, let's talk about it. Tell people, get active.
Get the word out, because most people, are not even aware it's there, that there's an opportunity to enforce something that most families are dying to find a solution and as quickly as possible, because the threat is just, like you said, is bigger and bigger every day. The risk of losing a loved one is so significant when you're dealing with substance abuse.
We are our brother's keeper. I mean, if you're going to live in a community, guess what? You're your brother's keeper. And, if you see somebody that's in pain, that's dealing with this issue, then care enough to say something to them. As opposed to, it's not my family, it's never going to affect me. Well, guess what?
It will.
It will affect you. Ultimately, it will affect you, unless you have no friends and no family.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
You're living in a bubble. But we are our brother's keeper. And if you want to live in a great community, then you got to be a little bit active and say, I care about the people that I share my county with, or my city with, or my town with. And if I see somebody who is dealing with this issue, then I'm going to speak up and offer to help them or give them access to a resource. And I think that's what it's about.
Nice. Very well said.
Yeah, it is. And Mark, we're going to have your on our show summary and on iTunes. We will have links and backlinks to your website. And we're going to wrap up here in about 9 minutes. But we'll definitely, just so you know that. And I appreciate you saying that, you know, and it just speaks to your character that, you know, because I know that sometimes lawyers get a bad rap, you know what I mean? But Mark is definitely, first a public servant, you know, trying to get the word out and trying to get people connected to the help that they need. And like Cindy and myself, we're kind of national, you know what I mean? This show is listened to by everybody in the United States and a couple of Western European countries. So we are a resource for you. We're all a resource to try to help folks get
Absolutely.
Connected with treatment and or coaching.
Whatever services they need.
Yeah, for sure. So I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, that was the heart, Mark. I really felt that from the heart. And I'm hoping our listeners really heard what you were saying, is that we all have accountability to support and help those that are in need.
I think at some point in time, we all experience a little personal growth, and it took me a long time to realize that when it comes to being a lawyer, that it's about helping people so I can grow my business, not about just growing my business and making tons of money. And so
exactly.
My philosophy is that I'm going to help a lot of people, my business is going to grow, and then I'm going to help a lot more people. And that's
right.
You know, really
that's
the
mentality. That's the service mentality. And I think like that rings and resonates so well in the coaching profession, because coaches from all walks of life come to help different people, with different sets of needs. You know, the sober coach, the recovery coach, the business coach, the personal development, they're all doing it to serve. Yeah. And I hear that so much in what you just said, that these people really need help. I mean, to have a family lose a family member, or the risk of, I mean, it's very dangerous. I mean, you know, I live in Huntington Beach, California. I mean, it affects everybody, and you hear horrible stories about families losing loved ones, young people who have never even started their life. It's tragic. So there's a way to get involved with some attorneys out here, get it going. If California did it, boy, I think that would be a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think eventually, you know, we'll get that. I think because I think what we're starting to realize is that. And I realized this a long time ago, even as a very young prosecutor, is that the majority of people who are in the criminal justice system, they're not bad people. Most of them are dealing with this issue.
I know.
I mean, at one end of the spectrum, you've got people who did silly things, like maybe they stole, you know, something small, or they got a DUI where nobody was hurt. And then the other end, you've got your very serious offenders, you know, sexual offenders, you know, murderers, rapists, and those types of folks. But right in the middle is 80% of the people who, you know, I mean, they're dealing with this issue, and they've ended up in the criminal justice system either because they couldn't afford to get treatment or just wasn't offered, or, I mean, for whatever reason. But so ultimately, you know, we're going to have to, you know, this issue is going to have to be addressed, because our courts are going broke. I mean, they just don't have the money.
Right. And what it costs to keep somebody in the system and in jail, and, you know, it affects everybody on that level.
Right.
You know, And what an interesting tertiary mechanism, you know. I mean, this is tertiary, right? It's really after the fact. It's not primary prevention. It's not secondary prevention. It's we're providing the treatment. And I'm thinking, I was in a newspaper or a couple of the East Bay Times in the Bay, you know, San Francisco 2 weeks ago about marijuana. And so I think somebody else is going to pick me up in Colorado. Man, what we're finding in states, you know, it's going to be, you know, California, Colorado, Washington, right? When you're going to have these legalized recreational uses, you're just going to have more incidents of use, period, end of story.
Absolutely.
And once you increase that base rate of usage, right, one, the initial rate of usage goes to a younger crowd, now starting in fifth grade, used to be eighth grade, and on and on and on. And that's and therefore, right, once you put these chemicals in the hands of folks that may not be biochemically suited have the maturity to use socially, you're just exposing them to something that they can become addicted to, and therefore you're going to have an exponential increase in addiction in that state. I mean, and so there's no making that foul ball fly straight. And therefore, right, there would have to be mechanisms, I think, like Marchman Act, call it whatever's law or whatever, right, to address now this burgeoning addiction population. Now, I mean, I'm not trying to say, I mean, what do you think about that, Mark? You think it's just me being an old man here just calling foul, or you think there's some validity to
that? Well, I think
that
means we're both old men then, doesn't it? I just turned 50 at the beginning of the year, so
there you
You know, look, I think obviously legalizing marijuana, I mean, there are some people in the treatment industry who say it's a gateway drug, and perhaps it is. And then, you know, there are other people that we know of who are have written about and talked about using marijuana as a way to, you know, as a method of detox, as opposed to, you know, putting somebody in detox and then giving them, you know, Suboxone or some other type of opioid, which is just a legalized drug. So, I mean, you know, it goes both ways. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of it's about education. I mean, back in the 90s when I was a prosecutor, I mean, you know, we had DUIs coming out of the woodwork. If you go on the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office website and, you know, scroll down to see who got arrested last night for DUI, I mean, on a typical day, you know, typical night, it's five or six people. That's it. I mean, it's not, you know, the significant amount of people that it was. And I think part of that is education. Part of that is the fact, you know, that it's the sanctions
penalties
that have been involved. But yeah, it's the penalties, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, I think obviously if it's been legalized recreationally in Colorado, they're going to have an uptick. It's kind of like, but what's the alternative to ban it? I mean, we tried that with alcohol and that didn't seem to do anything. So you got to educate people, and there's always going to be a small percentage of the population that's going to abuse that right or is more prone to abusing it and suffering the consequences as a result. So, I mean, there's no one answer for it. I mean, it's a multi-front attack.
I think I have to agree with Bruce that I would be shocked if the stats didn't go up in terms of addiction. And also, it's not a legalization issue so much that we're talking about. It's just that, you know, especially with the medical marijuana and the higher percentages of THC and the wax, which is straight THC, can affect that not just from a substance abuse standpoint, but from a mental illness, mental disorder standpoint. It puts certain people with certain brain chemistry at risk.
I agree.
Right.
I agree.
Right.
But I remember going to school in the 70s and kids were smoking weed, so it's not something new.
It's not new, but the percentages of THC in the weed that the kids are smoking is significantly higher.
I agree. Yeah, that listen, well, we've got all these other drugs down here that are, they're being mixed with heroin that are killing kids.
Yes.
Right out of the gate. So,
it's definitely a big issue.
On that note.
Yes.
On that note, we got to wrap it up here. We got about a minute left here. So, Mark, once again, thank you so much for coming on the show. If you would, tell us how our listeners and podcast listeners can access your website and your phone number and those things. Go ahead.
Okay, great. First of all, thank you both for having me on the show. I was honored and flattered that you asked me. Thank you very much.
Very much a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. So my website is drugandalcoholattorneys.com. So it's drugandalcoholattorneys.com. And the phone number for the office is 561-419-6095. And if you didn't get a chance to write it down or remember it, it's on the top of the website, drugandalcoholattorneys.com.
Thank you so much.
Excellent. Well, thanks for being with us, man. Always a pleasure. I can't wait to see you again here in a few weeks once I venture back down to Florida. It's always a
pleasure.
And, you know, man, Mark has a passion and a zeal that is just unbelievable and just a real good guy. So, well, I can be reached at conciergecoach.net. And Cindy, what's your contact information?
Can be reached at wisdomfoods.com and 714-943-6206.
All righty then. And with that said, thanks again for listening to the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. Bruce Cameron along with Cindy DeFerdinand. Make sure you talk, you know, dial in and click on us next week for another great show here on the Concierge Coaches Show. Have a great week, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Cindy DeFerdinand, only on LA Talk Radio.